then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's August the 12th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune.
Okay, before we get into this week's show, there's something I want to tell you guys, and I want to do it now before I forget about it later on. One of the big naysays and complaints we get about the Northwest migration is, oh, Harold, Harold, there ain't no jobs in the Northwest. Bulldust. We, just this past month or so, brought two new people into one of our primary settlement areas, Cold, and they both got hired within a week of their arrival. A third relocated within the homeland itself, so he doesn't really count as an incomer, but he's starting a new job as well. Now, it's true these people did have marketable skills to begin with, and it's true that if you're now flipping burgers in Pittsburgh or Hoboken or Amarillo, you'll probably end up flipping burgers here, at least at first. But I'm here to tell you that if you do have a marketable skill and you're willing to play the game and go through the motions just like you would anywhere else, you can get a job here and probably get a job a lot easier than you can elsewhere in the country. Okay, now let's kick off with our weekly Edgar Steele update. So far as anyone knows, the trial is still scheduled to begin on Monday, August the 16th. My guess is that it'll take a couple of weeks. At this point, there's not much merit in speculating on the outcome. It's pretty clear that the federal case against Steele is incredibly weak. Basically, all they seem to have is a few video and audio tapes in which those who've heard them claim to have detected serious audio anomalies in the crucial points in the conversation between Steele and the federal informant Larry Fairfax, the points where Steele is supposed to be actually discussing the murder-for-hire plot. Fairfax himself is so compromised by his own arrest for planting a bomb in Cindy Steele's SUV that I'm surprised that the government is still relying on him, but I suppose they have no choice. Now, I really think we need to be looking at one crucial point here. Who is this public defender that Edgar Steele has been lumbered with because the government deliberately seized all his bank accounts and assets? Now, maybe I missed it somewhere, but does anyone on our side even know his name? I just read over all the published news media reports on the case again, and maybe I just missed it, but I don't think even the media have given us this guy's name. They just refer to him as a quote-unquote public defender. Is this attorney any good? Does he show up for court prepared and sober, or does he slouch into the courtroom unshaven in a sweaty shirt and reeking of last night's bourbon binge? A lot of public defenders are basically courthouse loafers, ward healers, and hopeless drunks who can't get any other employment anywhere else in the legal system because they've been caught in acts of dishonesty or perjury and because they're so dysfunctional in their personal lives. It could well be that freezing Ed Steele's assets was a deliberate attempt on the part of the regime to make sure he ended up with a lousy lawyer who won't ask any embarrassing questions, but who'll sort of mumble his way through the trial. Now, can this man be relied upon to stand up in that courtroom and ask the pointed questions that need to be asked? Will the subject of possible politically motivated government entrapment even be broached at all in the jury's hearing? Will he subject the federal informant Larry Fairfax to a genuine, searching cross-examination, not only as to his actions, but as to his motives? Will he delve deeply into the length and nature of Fairfax's contacts with the FBI? Or will he just slough off Fairfax's cross with a few mumbled irrelevancies? Or will he take the line that, oh no, we mustn't mention possible government fabrication because because that will prejudice the jury and get the judge angry at me. Does he have the strength of character to demand that the government pay for an independent audio expert to examine the original tapes, or I should more likely say the original digital audio recordings of Edgar Steele allegedly asking this idiot Fairfax to kill his family? By the way, for those of you who are interested in the ins and outs and technical details of the case itself, so far as we know them, there is a new website at www.takeourworldback.com/steelframeup.htm. That's takeourworldback.com/steelframeup.htm. Now, if you can't get that, email me and I'll send it to you. This is a pretty good rundown of the facts insofar as the facts are known. All right, now on to another topic. Last week, I sent out a message to our several lists asking whether or not you folks would be interested in hearing 2 Radio Free Northwests per week, if I could manage it. I got a fairly comprehensive response with some good suggestions and arguments on both sides of the issue, but the overall consensus of opinion seems to be no. Well, vox populi, vox dei. But one bit of feedback I got from 2 individuals rather surprised me. Now, these gentlemen suggested that I drop the music entirely. One guy said I'm supposed to be a political leader and not a disc jockey, and the other said that when he's listening to Radio Free Northwest, he forwards over the music breaks completely. Well, so far, that's a minority point of view, although, as I've mentioned before, there are some of you who've told me that I ought to be actually more of a disc jockey and play rock music of various types in order to attract young people. I can, in fact, see that viewpoint in theory, although I'm not sure how well it would work out in practice if we can't somehow locate where the young white people hang out on the internet and get our listenership over its present 1,500 or so per week. Well, make that 2,200 or so if we assume that every single hit to the website downloads and listens to Radio Free Northwest, but I don't think we can really make that assumption. I have, in fact, gotten a lot of emails and letters from people telling me that the music I play is one of the main reasons that they do listen to Radio Free Northwest. I've explained that one of the guiding principles behind my selections is that I want to try and awaken a sense of history and heritage in young white people, those of our listeners who are under 40. And they can't very well be awakened to anything unless they're exposed to it somewhere, can they? Now, this was also the thought behind a series of email articles I wrote some years ago, in which I still send out about twice a year to anyone who wants them, entitled The Weird Aryan History Series. Now, someone once said that Americans are a people without a past. I once saw a statistic to the effect that less than 50% of Americans, meaning white Americans, can name all 4 of their grandparents. I mean actually name them. Grandpa and Mima don't count. And less than 10% could name more than 1 great-grandparent. Now, many Americans confuse the Korean War with World War II. Something like 30% of the reporters in the Gulf War did not know that there had been a World War I, although you'd think the designation of World War II might have tipped them off that there was a previous version floating around somewhere. True story. We as a people have no idea where we've been, so it's no wonder that we have no idea where we're going. Now, the Weird Aryan History series I put together is an attempt to remedy that, to inform white nationalists of some of the more interesting events in the history of our people, and let them know that, yes, in fact, there were Aryan events going on before the time of cowboys and Indians, which is as far back as most Americans have any historical awareness at all. Now, that's pretty much the case, you know. I'm not exaggerating. Beyond a highly inaccurate movie version of the Wild West, some Americans have a vague impression of the Civil War, including some hobbyists and some reenactors who are downright anal about the 1861-1865 period, to the exclusion of the other 3,000-odd years of Western civilization. Just like some National Socialists can recite a day-by-day history of the Third Reich from 1933 to 1945, and nothing else historical at all. Beyond that, there's a dimmer impression in a few consciousnesses of George Washington crossing the Delaware, and guys in white wigs signing something in 1776. And beyond that, there's Elmer Fudd in Puritan dress, wearing a cartoon steeple crown hat and carrying a blunderbuss, hunting for turkeys for Thanksgiving while having run-ins with a wascally wabbit. Anyway, for 99% of Americans, that's it. That's their sense of history. And by the way, nobody in the 17th or 18th centuries hunted with a blunderbuss. That'd be about like trying to hunt with a sawed-off shotgun. And speaking of Elmer Fudd and his blunderbuss Thanksgiving turkey hunt, one of the later articles in the Weird Aryan History series actually tracked down the proclamation of the first Thanksgiving in the colony of Massachusetts. And it turns out that in reality it was proclaimed in 1678 and not 1621, so it didn't have a damn thing to do with the Pilgrims. It was in June and not November, and so far from being a love feast with their kind and gentle Indian neighbors, the first Thanksgiving was a celebration of a white military victory over the Indians in what was called King Phillips War. In addition to being a people with cultural amnesia, we're also a very sleazy people, as witness our preoccupation with court TV and assorted media-hyped crap from Scott Peterson to Natalie Holloway and Lindsay Lohan. Fine, I'm sleazy too, so I selected all kinds of weird, wonderful, violent, bloody, bizarre, and ghastly stuff from the history of our race, and I presented it for our own little tabloid show here on the internet. I started off with the mystery of the princes in the tower, and then I went on for another 55 emails covering such wild and wonderful subjects as great white military victories like Rorke's Drift and Adobe Walls, historical oddities like the case of the vanishing diplomat and that insane spring-heeled Jack goo-boo, old murder mysteries like the death of Amy Robsart and the assassination of King Edward the Martyr in Saxon times, a lot of mysterious occult and paranormal stuff like the Mary Celeste and the Phantom Airships of the 1800s, that kind of thing. Plus, there's a lot of good solid history from every era of our race's long annals, military, political, social, literary, so forth and so on. Now, some of the articles were fairly long and some quite short. A few readers loved it. And most of them, well, it was pretty obvious. Most of you just considered the series one of Harold's little eccentricities. Now, that always saddened and disappointed me. I don't understand why I could never seem to get any traction with this. I mean, I just don't get it. How can anyone not be fascinated with all this stuff? Now, it's the same with the music I play on here. This is the soul of our race I'm trying to capture and convey here to people who have long since forgotten that we have one. I know that musical tastes are always going to differ from person to person, but these songs I play aren't just about a catchy tune. They're about us, about who we are. In some of those older songs, our forefathers who lived before the age of phonographs and digital recording are speaking to us from times past as best they can. I honestly don't get why anyone wouldn't want to listen. Okay, now we have an audio selection from a lady named Gretchen in Connecticut who is doing a couple of short book reviews for us.
Good evening, comrades. I would like to discuss two books on anthropology. First of all, I would like to discuss Richard D. Furl's book on human evolution called Erectus Walks Amongst Us. This highly illustrated book is a joy to read. In this work, Furl purports an out-of-Asia theory of human evolution. Furl argues this alternative, I believe, as a method of raising reasonable doubt and thus to disarm an origins theory which can be used to diminish white morale. To digress, morale, I believe, is just as important as absolute truth, which frankly, in the case of out of Asia versus out of Africa, as we will learn from Farrell, is at best speculative. Farrell's book also discusses relatedness. It points out that you can maximize your genetic gain in any offspring by choosing a racially similar partner with copies of your alleles. Farrell has a large section on policy in the back of the book. If you don't wish to read about evolution, then just skip to the policy chapters. What Furl attempts to do in this section is to remind us that we can decide what traits are trivial or not. So if someone says it's trivial if your grandchildren are nothing like you, you can decide it isn't. Furl warns that a product of mixed marriage tends to side against white conflict. Furl also speaks of the sense of alienation many white women feel towards non-white offspring. Emoting on the destruction brought about by interracial marriage, Furl says it is akin to dynamiting a cathedral. Furl maintains that whites need homelands where they have the will to resist because of a belief in their right to exist. Furl states that even if whites were evil to the core, which they are not, that it would be far more evolutionarily productive to rejoice in evilness than to become suicidal altruists. After all, Furl says a snake that decides it can't eat rabbits is no longer a snake, and, in short order, it isn't at all. At the end of the book, Farrell gives a rendered reading list. Frank Salter's book on genetic interests is among the listed work. Salter's book states that genetic interests are valid even if we believe out-of-Africa theory. This work expands on related tables that we find in Farrell's book. In Salter's work, the individual who wishes to maximize genetic gain is called a rational fitness maximizer. Salter points out graphically the genetic loss resulting from reckless outbreeding and advocates state power as the most effective force for preserving genetic interests. Salter states that citizens would be justified, based on adaptive utilitarian ethic, to reform or tear down their state and build new ones whose efforts ethnic composition and constitution better serve their genetic survival? Well, Furl asks rhetorically, what is the most valuable possession populations have? And answers, it is their genome. This kind of good sense is hard to find today, which is why I recommend both books. If a comrade did not care to read all of Salter's work, there is a summation to be found online, which is actually clearer than Salter's book. However, I advocate reading both, if for no other reason than to cultivate mental discipline. If you have never read a work like Salter's, you may wish to read Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene, which can help introduce you to Salter's type of writing. Thank you for your time, comrades. I hope to return with other ideas for Harold's show.
Would it surprise you to learn that Gretchen is a librarian? I'm still waiting for other audio submissions from the rest of you. Okay, maybe book reports aren't exactly the most inspiring heights of revolutionary rhetoric, but then let's see what you can do. I'm frankly not interested in hearing any criticism of Gretchen. I'm interested in hearing you do better. The underlying principle here, people, is that there have to be voices other than mine speaking out for this cause of Northwest independence, because we don't know how long you're going to keep on hearing mine, and they need to be authentic voices. Now, some people have asked why I don't do a call-in show like most other right-wing and racial radio people do. Now, there are a number of reasons for that. First off, at the moment, I don't have the technical know-how. Secondly, because it might involve using Skype, and I still haven't forgotten the almost 100 virus-filled files that were found during my last computer rebuild, almost all of which appear to have slithered in via Skype. Now, third, while I can't control what others do as part of their efforts for Northwest independence, I can control what goes out with my name attached to it, and I intend to do so. It's an unfortunate fact that our movement attracts a lot of dysfunctional weirdos, and I have no intention of giving them one more forum in which to cackle and gibber and bang their heads on the wall about things that do not matter. We've already got VNN for that. Neither would I allow Jews or niggers or lefty creeps to call in. They have all the rest of the internet where they can go to vomit. They're not going to do it here. Now, this is one place that remains strictly seg. I have a little under an hour here every week. I waste too much of that time myself already with my Grandpa Simpson-like digressions. I'm not going to let kikes, niggers, and goat dancers waste it. But like I said, we need voices other than mine here, and you guys need to begin learning the rudiments of how to use this technology so that someday we can have a dozen and then 100 Radio Free Northwests on the net. I meant it when I told the people who want me to play AC/DC and skinhead rock and techno heavy metal or whatever on here that they need to put together their own show, and we'll see how their way of doing things works out. Who knows, maybe they're right, but we're never going to know until somebody besides me tries. I got an email the other day from a comrade in Oregon chastising me for my attitude towards alcohol in the movement. He tells me I have no right to tell people not to drink. Well, that's not exactly what I say to people. I simply maintain that we won't accomplish anything with people who are drunk or high on drugs, and the only way to make sure that revolutionaries are never drunk or high on drugs when we need them in position and functional is to forbid the use of any intoxicants of any kind, hence General Order No. 10 in the Northwest novels. Now, normally when I get these questions, I clip this one section from the brigade where Billy Jackson is explaining to a couple of recruits the reason for General Order No. 10, and I email it to whoever has brought the subject up. I won't go over the whole booze thing again, except to remind you folks that I lived through the Glenn Miller experience. And no, that's not a jazz band. I've learned the hard way that alcohol and gunpowder don't mix, and also that alcohol and white nationalist politics don't mix. I don't drink myself anymore because I can't for medical reasons. But even before that issue arose, I was winding it way down. I'd come to realize down through the years that I just wasn't getting anything out of it anymore. However, I don't want you people to think that I'm some kind of prude. So here's a drinking song for you. This is Mike Cross.
Sun wouldn't shine. I was walking down the street and not feeling too fine. I saw two old men with a bottle between them. This is the song I heard them singing. Lord preserve us and protect us. We've been drinking whiskey for breakfast. Well, I stopped by the steps where they were sitting and I couldn't believe how drunk they were getting. I said, old men, you've been drinking long. They said, long enough to start singing this song. Lord preserve us and protect us. We've been drinking whiskey for breakfast. Thank you. so good that I just couldn't quit. So I drank a little more. Next thing I knew, there were three of us sitting there singing this tune. Lord, preserve us and protect us. We've been drinking whiskey for breakfast. Well, one by one, everybody in the town heard our ruckus and they all came down. And pretty soon all the streets were ringing with the sound of the whole town laughing and singing. Lord, preserve us and protect us. We've been drinking whiskey for breakfast. Yes, Lord, preserve us and protect us. We've been drinking whiskey for breakfast.
This question comes from Lewis in North Carolina. Dear HAC, what do you think about the Obama economy, and will it be able to recover at all, or is this the balloon finally going up, although to be sure it's going up a bit more slowly than we'd thought? Well, Lewis, I think I'll start out with a quote from Margaret Thatcher. The trouble with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money. I know I chastise the Tea Party people for being obsessed completely with economics and no mention at all of race, but yeah, economics are important, and I've never denied that. At the risk of sounding like some kind of neocon, the fact is that it's been obvious for some years now that things simply can't go on the way they are economically because the ratio of producers to parasites has dropped too low. It's the old conflict between those who pay the taxes and those who eat the taxes. Now, simple mathematics should tell anybody with two brain cells to rub together that if you're spending more than you're taking in, then you have two choices. Either you increase income or you cut costs. Now, in the old days, before paper money and interest on loans were invented by the Jews, and everybody traded in silver and gold coins that had to be mined and minted and can't just be created on a computer terminal, there were periods of economic instability, sure, especially when the king or baron or whoever debased the coinage. There were times when government spending outreached income, but that was mostly in time of war or famine or plague when the system was really strained by outside factors. And these episodes never really lasted long because the governments of medieval and Renaissance city-states or kingdoms eventually had no choice but to balance the budget. There was only so much gold and silver coin available, and when you ran out, you ran out. Now, in this country, where the Jews of the Federal Reserve can simply wave their pudgy fingers and cause trillions of dollars to spring into being off the magic printing presses, we have almost a century of deficit spending behind us now. That's like living for 100 years on a credit card that never runs out, but it keeps running up interest. And eventually, even the biggest credit card in the world, which is what the United States government is, runs out and you have to pay up. Now, the situation now is this. There is only one thing that will keep the present Democratic regime afloat. With all its attempts to take over health care and nationalize all the major industries and create a social democratic, politically correct welfare state, etc., etc., not to mention fund two pointless and endless wars in the Middle East and maybe a third when Israel finally attacks Iran. That one thing that will keep Obongo going is an endless Niagara Falls of cash, a flow of money without end, and they can't get that anymore. The private business sector is now pretty much taxed to the limit, not what they can pay, but what they will pay. Beyond this point, business will either flat out leave the country or else businessmen will engage in massive tax evasion like they did in Ireland when I was there. Remember, I lived in socialist Ireland in the 1980s when the basic tax rate was 64%. Tax evasion was the national sport, bigger than hurling or soccer since a lot more people were playing it. Evading the revenue commissioners was a national industry. The Irish government would confiscate any ill-gotten or untaxpaid booze or gasoline or cigarettes they found, and sometimes they'd seize businesses, but they didn't impose jail terms for tax evasion because if they had done, they would literally have had to lock up half the country. Tax fiddling was that widespread. I remember we had 20% unemployment on the books, but in actual fact it wasn't nearly as bad as that, because most people on the dole also had a nixer, as they called it, on the side. Some private enterprise job they would do for cash under the table. Auto repair, laying carpet, construction, or running a stall in an open-air market, whatever. Now, the ones who were really stuck were the bureaucrats and civil servants. Most of them had to put in a full work week for a salary that was gutted by the crushing welfare state taxes. The Democrats' dream of somehow getting their hands on the real wealth of multinational corporations, the way they've shaken down the tobacco industry over the past 30 years, and the way they shook down BP for $20 billion just recently, so forth and so on. But I think they've reached the limit of what they can raise there, because the multinationals have gotten the message that the American regime is a bunch of thieves and extortionists, and they're going to start pulling all their wealth out of the country and out of the range of the IRS, like the rest of BP's oil rigs have done. Major American corporations as well will simply get out and move their international headquarters to Europe or the Bahamas. Now, this flight of foreign and domestic capital will, of course, do wonders for the American economy. The liberals and the Democrats have killed the goose that lays the golden eggs there. Now, they can also try taxing the bejesus out of what remains of the white middle class, and that, in essence, is the way they're planning on paying for Obamacare. In theory, everybody will have to buy it, but the premiums will be means-tested so that what ends up happening is that a white middle-class family of four with two Republican votes pays $15,000 or $20,000 per year for their Obamacare, while a newly amnestied Mexican family with six or eight Democrat votes pays $150 a year for their Obamacare. Get the picture? The problem is that that's another golden goose that's on the point of expiring. Whites don't have the expertise at hiding or shifting their money that the multinational corporations have, and they're too spineless to revolt. But the fact is that in very short order, if white people have to pay all those doctor and medical bills for millions of non-contributing blacks and Mexicans, eventually they're going to run out of money as well. So in the medium term, probably within the next couple of years, the Democrats are going to have to find some other way besides taxation to keep the endless river of cash flowing that they have in order to basically buy off their own political base among the unions and the minorities and keep themselves in power, because the Chinese won't lend them any more money and they simply won't be able to tax enough. Now, the rich won't pay, the non-white poor not only won't but can't pay, and the white middle class will have been reduced to such poverty through unemployment and foreclosure and the wreckage of their 401ks that they can't pay anymore either. Now, there will be this huge imbalance between government income and expenditure that can only be resolved one way, and that's by the government printing money. A number of financial writers like Chris Ruddy and Ambrose Evans Pritchard in England claim that the Federal Reserve is already doing that. They're just keeping it all very hush-hush. Oh, they'll try a few last-gasp tricks to keep things on an even keel, most likely slashing the defense budget, which is really something you want to do when you're fighting two brush fire wars. It does wonders for the morale of the troops in the field. Now, as I pointed out before, Economics 101 teaches us that just firing up those printing presses and running the bills off a few trillion at a time increases the money supply, which lessens the value of cash because there's more of it, and that causes galloping inflation. Now, this is why counterfeiting is such a serious offense. Injecting unauthorized funny money into the system upsets the balance and devalues the currency. But now it's going to be our illustrious government who is injecting the funny money into our economy, the same as any counterfeiter, because it's nothing but pieces of paper with green ink on it. And that means raging inflation like they had in Weimar Germany in the 1920s after the Allies stole all Germany's gold reserve. Inflation like they used to have in Israel before the Jews completely changed the currency and instituted ruthless wage and price controls like they won't let us do here. Inflation like Zimbabwe now has, which is what happens basically when you let niggers play with a printing press. And my friends, when you have rampaging inflation, that means that money is worthless. That means that the wonderful regime of the One will be paying its employees in worthless monopoly money, including its mercenaries in law enforcement and the military. That means that military and FBI salaries and pensions will become worthless because they'll be paid in bogus dollars that Obama and Ben Bernanke just ran off the printing press. That means that the regime will very quickly lose all its support. Oh, and by the way, the states and municipalities have already started going bankrupt as well, especially Illinois and California, and they won't be able to pay their cops and sheriff's deputies and state troopers. All across the country, some cities and towns are already laying off police and firefighters. Now, that will be our window, people, when Zog can no longer pay their mercenaries. In the 1980s, when the Order revolted, the FBI flooded the Pacific Northwest with a small army of 800 agents. Do you think they'll be able to do that again? with agents who are only being paid in monopoly money and whose families no longer have access to health care or benefits, whose kids are actually starving in their suburban split levels back in Falls Church or Silver Spring, Maryland, because the infrastructure's broken down and there's no food in the stores and no real money to buy it with if there was? And what do you think the average FBI agent is going to do in a situation like that? Stay there to help his family, however he can, or is he going to drop everything and run off to the Northwest to go sneaking in and out among the Douglas firs hunting for us just to save Barack Obama's caramel-colored ass? Do you think in a few years' time, if some Jerry Reb-related trouble starts, the mayor of Seattle or Portland or the governors of Washington and Oregon will necessarily be able to pick up the phone and holler for the 82nd Airborne when the 82nd Airborne and the 3rd Marine Division and most of the state's National Guards are sitting in some godforsaken valley in Afghanistan or trying to organize an offensive on Tehran, Iran for the third time? And those soldiers and sailors and Marines who do remain here at home aren't getting paid and their families aren't being taken care of either? I mean, really, guys, come on. Never mind this stupid red, white, and blue horse shit you see on the movies and on TV. How many federal employees of any kind or any race will seriously be willing to risk their lives and risk leaving their families alone and unprovided for when they die in some ambush in a northwest forest or from some bomb detonation on a street in Portland? Are they going to do this purely out of faith in a system and a government that they will by then surely understand to be completely corrupt and rotten to the core? A system that doesn't give a damn about them? So to answer your question, Lewis, yes, maybe. It could well be that for all my emphasis on race, it may be that the economic side of things provides us with our window of opportunity. Now, this is Talking Heads.
This ain't no fooling around. I'm gonna hold you. were tapping phone lines. No, not that in love. We dress like students, we dress like housewives, or in a suit and a tie. Changed my hairstyle so many times now. What I look like? You make me shiver, I feel so tender. We make a pretty good team.
By the way, guys, that was from the 80s, and it's probably about as rock and roll-y as I'm likely to get on this show. Now, this next comes from an individual using the rather appropriate email handle of Hammerhead. Dear Mr. Covington, you keep saying you have a plan, but so what if everybody does move to the Northwest? The Northwest is nothing. The Northwest is full of liberals and stupid white people, and besides, it's too damn cold. Well, I'm tempted to say, okay, Hammerhead, you stay down there in nice balmy San Diego and keep on lounging around and drinking beer and shaving your head and flashing your tats and acting big and badass, and we'll see what happens. But guys, we can't really refuse to answer a question simply on the grounds that it's stupid. We can't just abandon white people, any white people. We have this horrible habit of writing our own people off the minute they let their skulls full of mush show, and that has to stop. There are simply too many of those skulls full of mush out there. We have to bring them in from the cold, pardon my mixed metaphors. Now, these people are all our brothers and sisters, even the ones who are sullen and hostile, who have had their brains washed squeaky clean, or who, as in this case, don't know how to think. Always remember why they can't think and why they seem so obtuse. It's not their fault. They have been made that way by the Jews, socially engineered not to be able to think and not to ask certain questions. We can never give up on them. Okay, Hammerhead, let's take it from the top. Now, I'm going to do you the courtesy of assuming that you're bona fide in that you really are looking for some kind of realistic solution for this problem, which you should be, because believe me, by the time you get to be my age, if nothing changes in this society, you're going to be living in a world of misery that none of us can possibly imagine. Not just outnumbered by the MUDs, but with no young white people left to maintain essential goods and services and infrastructure, no white cops and no white firefighters, no white doctors and no white nurses. You're going to be living in a world about like Iraq or Uganda, with 3 hours of electricity per day if you're lucky, and nothing else left of the old world that you were born into. Now, the white racial nationalist movement has completely wasted the past 50 years. It's now no longer possible for white people to recapture the whole North American continent. No more Ozzie and Harriet, guys. No more Brady Bunch. No more 4th of July picnics. No more white bread. No more cardigan sweaters and bobby socks. Bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. You get the idea. The only remaining option to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children is for the remnant of the racially conscious population of North America to relocate to the Pacific Northwest and establish our own sovereign nation. Now, what is at stake here is our survival as a race. There is no longer any alternative to the Northwest migration plan. If this is not done, then the white race will perish from the North American continent and most likely from the rest of the earth as well, since there will be no safe haven where our people can rest, regroup, and replenish our numbers. The problem of racial survival has to be reduced to manageable proportions. We have to shrink it to dimensions where we can concentrate what few remaining resources we have into a smaller area with shorter and closer interior lines of communication. On such a reduced scale, if we can recover some physical courage and the will to confront the enemy instead of running away and hiding, we will be able to claw back some of what we once had here. Now, if this isn't done, then the white race will become extinct in North America, probably by about the year 2100. The white birth rate right now is in negative integers. We're not only not reproducing ourselves, but as older white people die off every year, our overall numbers and percentage of the Earth's population shrinks, and it'll continue to do so without a homeland where we can work on getting our numbers back up. The consequences of white racial extinction for human civilization and for the planet upon which we live would be horrific beyond the power of the imagination to encompass. Basically, once we're gone, the black and brown races will never be able to maintain what we've built, and the yellow race will not want to support all those black and brown freeloaders like we have. Now, eventually what'll happen without the white man on the scene will be that the Orientals exterminate the niggers and mestizos and probably the Arabs as well, after a series of wars that will be cataclysmic and destroy what's left of civilization. It cannot be repeated often enough. The Northwest Imperative is above all driven by one single and decisive factor, that being the complete lack of any other realistic alternative plan to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. We have frittered away the past 50 years. The clock has run out, and there's nothing else left for us to do. The proposed white homeland consists of a core territory of three Northwest American states and part of a fourth, the states of Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and Montana, west of Interstate 15. At various times in the past, other parts of the Northwest have also been suggested as potentially part of the homeland. Now, these include roughly the northern third of California above Redding, the state of Wyoming, the state of Alaska, and the present Canadian provinces of British Columbia and Alberta. Personally, when the time comes that the Iron Heel from Washington finally lifts off our back and we can do the necessary, I'd like to glom onto as much as possible, but it's on those 3.5 states that we have to concentrate our initial resettlement efforts. The primary advantage to the whole Northwest concept, as opposed to this conservative illusion that we're somehow going to win back the whole country at once, is that the Northwest Imperative reduces the problem to manageable proportions, something that we can, in fact, accomplish with the resources at our command if we can ever get our act together. Now, we'll certainly never accomplish anything by just sitting on our computers and pecking on keyboards. The present status quo means racial death, and things have reached the point where, in my personal opinion, these people who are rubbishing the Northwest Imperative on V-bulletin boards and who are trying to preserve the present movement status quo just so they won't lose their little internet empires, or because they're too damn lazy to pack a moving van and hustle for a new job and a new start in a new place, these people have become part of the problem and not the solution. Now, at some point, when we actually get some boots on the ground here, comrades with some people skills who are willing to make a genuine commitment to freedom, white people who are willing not just to fight for the Northwest Republic, but to work for it, will have to establish a Northwest Agency, very similar in scope and purpose to the Jewish Agency that handled and still handles the bulk of the Jewish immigration to Israel. The Northwest Agency will not concern itself so much with political or propaganda issues, except in a very limited way to convince potential incomers of the necessity to come home. Now, the Northwest Agency absolutely must insist on at least one preliminary visit or scouting trip to the homeland by prospective incomers before they make the move, specifically a visit to the proposed area of settlement. Prospective migrants need to get a look at us, and we need to get a look at them. I know I keep urging people to pack the moving van, but you do know that that's largely rhetorical, right? Now, believe it or not, I'm not completely impractical about all this. In real life, nobody should simply pack up all their worldly goods into a U-Haul and head in a general northwesterly direction. Now, that is not what I'm asking, and it's not what I expect. Early pioneers who tried that kind of thing usually came to grief. Ask the survivors of the Donner Party. Every effort has to be made to ensure that prospective migrants are running to something, not running away from something. Prospective migrants, especially families, need to have jobs and accommodation lined up beforehand, and they need to arrive with sufficient assets so that they can immediately establish themselves in their new communities. Now, this can be done with a little work and a little preparation. As I mentioned at the beginning of this broadcast, there are, in fact, jobs here. They just don't fall right into your lap. You simply have to make the same kind of effort to get them that you'd make in your present locality. Now, if I can wander off the subject a little bit, a lot of people have asked me, what's the best way to come here to the homeland? Now, I've come in twice myself, once by Interstate 90 through South Dakota and Montana, and once down Interstate 84 through Idaho and Oregon along the Columbia River. It's hard to recommend a choice, although if you come along 90, I highly recommend that you make the time to stop off at the Little Bighorn National Monument where Custer and his men died. Now, that's an eerie place, a definite haunted air about it. A lot of people people, especially those from California, will be coming up Interstate 5, which is basically the West Coast's main drag, and that has some impressive stretches as well, especially down there around Weed, California, in the shadow of Mount Shasta. That's another mystical place. I can see why the hippy-dippy New Age types are fascinated with it. But I think the very best route for entering the homeland is through southern Idaho and then down Interstate 84 along the Columbia River, where you go past the various lakes and reservoirs that have been created by all the huge hydroelectric dams down there along the river. And then you go down towards Portland, down the west side of the Cascades, through the northern rainforest, the valleys and the falls, etc., etc. And if you're lucky, you can get through Portland and follow the river on down Highway 30 to Astoria, where the Columbia runs into the sea. There was a time a few years ago when I had to make the trip between Astoria and Longview, Washington on a regular basis every couple of weeks. And on a clear day, the sight of that mighty Columbia River spreading out below the town and under the great 4 mile bridge and on out to sea with the barren mountains rising on the Washington side, it's one of the most inspiring sights that you can ever see. I tried to describe it to you in words a little in my novel, The Brigade, but I think the Irish composer Sean Davey does it much better in music. If you ever ride down to Astoria, down Highway 30, you need to have this playing on your car stereo.
Thank you.
Finally, one last email. This one is from a gentleman named Stanislaus, who is emailing from Poland. I've cleaned up his English a bit. Dear Mr. Covington, I've been listening to your comments on the organization of your Northwest Revolution with great interest. If you're not going to have a properly organized party, then why not follow Louis Beam's leaderless resistance plan? Now, I've gotten some other questions about leaderless resistance, and so I suppose I need to get into that. Now, for those of you who don't know, in 1992, Louis Beam published an article in an underground magazine called The Seditionist, entitled Leaderless Resistance. Now, for the sake of brevity, I'm going to assume that most people reading this are familiar with the article. Anyone with any pretensions to white nationalism should be. Now, the fact is, the white nationalist movement, such as it is, has been practicing leaderless resistance for years, just not intentionally. You might say we've been making a virtue out of a necessity. Now, we've been forced to embrace leaderless resistance, if for no other reason than a near total lack of leaders. I won't go off into a long digression on that, since most of you are familiar with my views on the matter already. I agreed with Louis Beam's article for many years, and still agree with most of it, in theory. The problem is that, as so often occurs in life, out there in the real world, theory has run headlong into reality, and come off the worse for the encounter. The problem with leaderless resistance is the same problem we have with every other idea we've tried besides Northwest migration. It doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Because of the one issue that Louis Beam never foresaw, the one issue more important than any other, the one issue which we as a community consistently and adamantly refuse to face, the issue of character. We keep trying to drive a nail with a marshmallow and then wondering why we fail. In practice, leaderless resistance turned out to be all leaderless and no resistance. Louis Beam's article was predicated on the idea that the independent and unorganized cells or activity groups he envisions would actually do something. Now, this hasn't happened. Leaderless resistance has been used by the overwhelming majority of white males who claim to practice it as an excuse to avoid anything remotely resembling personal risk, inconvenience, or effort. White boys don't want to join an organization. They don't want to discipline themselves and conform their behavior to a set of rules. They don't want to stop drinking themselves into a stupor every night. They don't want to work with other white people as a team. They don't want to open their wallets and give up precious beer and cigarette money. They don't want to obey orders. They're not interested in anything remotely smacking of self-sacrifice, and yet out of ego or shame, they want to pretend to be resistance fighters. And so the magical words, leaderless resistance, cancel all these failings out. Now we say we're practicing leaderless resistance when all we're really doing is throwing a hissy fit. It has been used as an excuse to avoid politics, the rough and tumble of genuine face-to-face human interaction, not hiding behind a computer, where it's necessary to try and understand and respect the viewpoints of others and sacrifice one's own ego for the common good. Screw you, I'm practicing leaderless resistance. You're not the boss of me. Well, mister, if we're going to have any hope of survival eventually, somebody's going to have to be the boss of you. Now, above all, our comrades practicing leaderless resistance, or so they say, are very big on the necessity to, quote-unquote, keep a low profile. The implied hint is that they're covertly engaged in deep secret revolutionary activities off the radar screen. I have to keep a low profile because, you see, I'm practicing leaderless resistance, just like all those so-called PLEs they jabber about on the internet that nobody could ever find, until April Gatty set up only the second real one ever attempted. Now, this is horseshit. Nobody in the existing movement, other than the Northwest Imperative, are doing one damn thing besides spinning their wheels at the same old crap we were doing 20 or 30 years ago, and everyone hearing this knows it. Now, the only difference is that instead of the sad old men mailing each other newspaper clippings telling each other how bad it is, now they're sending each other news stories by email telling each other how bad it is. Leaderless resistance is being used as nothing more than an excuse to keep on hiding and dabbling and running away like frightened rabbits at the first hint of heat. Okay, now I suppose it's time to address something else I get all the time.
Well, Harold, why don't you do something? You want us all to lose our jobs and go to prison and get killed, so why don't you lead the way and go strap a bomb to yourself or blow something up or assassinate somebody?
Well, I don't do that because that is not what we are trying to accomplish. The purpose of this exercise is not for me to show how brilliant I am or what a big badass I am, nor is it about anybody else showing what a big badass and what a great man of destiny he is. The purpose of what we're doing is to change the world. What we're doing is not about my ego, my self-image, or your image of me. I don't give a damn what any of you think of me, just so long as you understand what I'm saying and you act on it. What we're doing here is not about your ego or your self-esteem either. I want you to listen to what I say, and I want you to act on it, and I don't give a damn about your feelings or your angst or what a hard life you've had or anything like that. The purpose of what we're doing is to change the world. What we're doing is not about killing anybody. It's not about dying for our new country. It is not about you having some kind of personal catharsis through violence. The purpose of what we are doing is to change the world. It's not about establishing or restoring anybody's so-called rights. There are no such things. The only rights that anyone really has are those he can enforce at the point of a sword. Because if you have to rely on someone else to safeguard and enforce your rights, then they're not really yours, are they? They're a gift from that other person who does hold the sword, whatever he decides to grant you. It's not about rights. It's not about justice. It's not about vengeance. It's not about redressing anyone's private wrongs. The purpose of what we are doing is to change the world. Now, that's why I don't go out and do some kind of personal kamikaze attack or suicide bombing. And that's why I urge that none of you go out and do anything stupid like that either. Not because it's wrong. We live in a society based on a moral inversion, and there is no more right or wrong. No, I am against silly suicidal acts, mine or anyone else's, because they wouldn't change anything. How do I know? Because it's been tried as recently as last February. Does anyone now remember even the name of Joseph Stack, the guy who crashed his plane into the IRS building in Austin, Texas? No. Joe Stack wanted change so badly he willingly laid down his life for it, and the public greeted his supreme sacrifice with a yawn and then changed the channel. Now, they say everyone should strive to leave the world a better place than when they found it. I simply want to leave it a different place, because almost any change at all would be an improvement. Now, that's why I do what I do, and that's why you should be doing it as well. The world must change, and I need your help. Now, when you decide to give it to me, you know where to find me. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. Now, this is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andenman, freedom.
Rising.